My name's Matthew Swinburne, I'm the Chair of the Committee, and thank you for coming and being part of our hearing today. These proceedings are being recorded by Hansard, and a copy of the audio will be placed on our committee's website in the next couple of days. As we are meeting by Zoom today, I'd like to advise you that present with me at our end is our committee staff and our Hansard reporter, and also the Honourable Samantha Rowe, the Deputy Chair, the Honourable Colin Holt, and the Honourable Tim Clifford. It's fine to call us by our first names. We're relatively informal on these things. And before we begin, just for the record, could you please state your full name and the capacity in which you appear before the committee?
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm Christina Lassenberger and I'm Professor of Politics at the University of Leeds in the UK, and my research is mainly on Parliament and citizens and a lot on petitions.
All right, thank you for that. You will have signed a document entitled Information for Witnesses. Have you had a chance to read and understand that document?
Yes, I have. Thank you.
If for some reason you wish to make a confidential statement during today's discussion, or if your evidence will include any sensitive or controversial material, such as an allegation about another person, you should request that the evidence be taken in private session. I might add we don't really anticipate that that will happen, but given the subject matter of our hearing. But if it does, and the committee grants your request, it may defer receipt of the confidential evidence and make alternative arrangements to receive that evidence from you. This is to ensure that the evidence will be received in secure conditions. A transcript of your evidence will be provided to you to assist the committee. If you refer to any documents, can you refer to their full title? Because we're using Zoom, if at any stage you can't hear us, perhaps just wave. And likewise, if we can't hear you, we might just wave at you as well. And obviously, we'll make the most of the technology. And so we'll see how we proceed. Just in terms of the transcript from today's hearing, it will be made public. And you'll be given an opportunity to make any corrections to it, but until it's made public, could you please ensure you keep it private and confidential? Do you have an opening statement? I think we want to proceed on a relatively informal basis, because I think what we want to do is extract from you as much information as we can, but in as a, you know, an easiest and comfortable way, because I think what I've noticed in this area is that there's not a lot of academic work being done on the petitions role, particularly of in the Westminster type systems, yet it seems to me it's an extremely important role that's happened. So if you want to make a general statement based on your research, please feel free to do so.
Thank you very much. There's a few questions that we'll go through, but as a general statement, what I'll say is that obviously petitions have been with us for centuries and centuries, and they've always been there, and no one really has paid much attention to them until with the 21st century, with the online petition, possibility of doing petitions, then they become much more important, people are much more aware of that. But it's also the fact that we have a society that is much more wanting to participate in things. So it's not just the technology, it's also that our society today, our public, is very different to our public, say, 50 years ago. They want to be involved, they want to have a say. And so we see an explosion of petition systems now, in particular with parliaments and becoming more electronics and more prevalent in what they do. And I'd say that the key thing about them that makes them work well is about being fair and clear and about being seen as and being integrated with parliamentary business. So being seen by the public as being fair and clear, but also being linked to parliamentary business so that they're not working parallel. And I think those two core principles are really important.
Okay, yeah. All right, so we've sent to you some questions that we want to go through, so we'll just work our way through those. So the first of those is that in your article attached to your submissions, you refer to addressing the public's expectation gap on petitions. Are you able to briefly describe for us the gap between the public's expectations of the petition system in the UK House of Commons and the reality before the reintroduction of the Petitions Committee?
Yeah. So the expectations gap was basically derived from the fact that the government, so not Parliament, the government at the time, decided to bring in an e-petition system. And they brought in an e-petition system, which to me, in fact, it was not a system, it was just a website. So a website which actually looked very trendy and, you know, very, you know, anyone could submit something really, really easily, was very accessible. And on the website, it said, if you get to 100,000 signatures, then this will be debated by Parliament. And in that, it was actually misleading because there was no process brought into Parliament. So it was something created by government with no talking with Parliament. But then obviously people were submitting these petitions, were signing these petitions, they were expecting that their petitions would be decided by Parliament. So they created a scenario where Parliament then had to accommodate that in one way or another. And the way they accommodated that was by having a backbench business committee at the time. I don't know if you're familiar with that backbench business committee. I don't know if you have one. But it was a committee that was brought in 2010 in the UK, and it's meant just for backbench business. So backbench MPs can bring in business through that. So it's obviously for them. But with government bringing in this idea that anyone could submit a petition and there was, you know, if you got 100,000 signatures, it would be debated in Parliament. Parliament then ended up by having a problem that it had to sort out. And the way they did it was by having the backbench business committee dealing with these petitions. But it meant that because of the procedural process of the backbench business committee, those petitions could only be debated if an MP would sponsor one of those petitions, bring it to Parliament, and then discuss it. And the expectation and the gap expectation was that the fact that the public would expect that if they had lots of signatures, then it would be automatically debated, when that was never the case. There wasn't even a process for that. So they raised the expectation very high that people could now bring issues to the fore, but they didn't create any processes to deal with those. And that's the change in 2015, is the creation of processes to deal with petitions, and with that, the creation of the Petitions Committee.
Thank you. And has the Petitions Committee, in your opinion, addressed this gap?
Yes, absolutely. I think so. You're never going to please all the public. You're never going to please everyone. But it's been right from the start, its aim has been to address that gap, to address the idea of expectations. And even in its creation, they said, you know, in the debate, they said, not all petitioners' views, matters will be able to be addressed, but we will listen to it. And that listening is really important. So by creating a petitions committee where you have members and staff just processing petitions, then you have someone listening to those, you have someone processing those and, you know, bringing in the views of the public. And by doing that, but at the same time, by being very clear in the information that they put out on the website, and I really want to emphasize that, how important that is, by making it clear what is possible, what is not possible. So one of the things that they've done particularly well is using, in some ways, the techniques from the government, because the system in the UK House of Commons is actually collaborative with government. So they've used that know-how, that technique, you know, the skills that the government digital service has in terms of accessibility and how to communicate with the public. They use that to make the Parliament petition site very accessible, very clear. So the site is very clear in using very simple language, saying, when you get 10,000 signatures, your government will respond. When you get 100,000 signatures, it will be considered for a debate. Not that it will be debated, but it will be considered. And all the communication is all very clear. So if you do a petition today, sign it, and if it's accepted, it'll be on the site. And in there, on the page of the petition, it will say, once this gets 10,000 signatures, you'll get a response from the government. If it gets to 100,000, you know, so information is always there, not just on the general site, but also with each petition. So by doing that, it's addressed that gap in two ways, by introducing processes that deal with the flow of petitions, and on the other hand, by keeping the information very clear and accessible and setting expectations at the right level, let's say. Basically, you know, you might agree or disagree with it, but if the rules are the rules and you explain the rules, then the public is going to accept those better.
And I suppose being successful creates its own risks in some regards. So, I mean, how would you recommend petitions committees balance this sort of success and managing, you know, reducing the expectation gap with the quality of the way they deal with petitions, and then the fact that, you know, if they're very good at it, then they're going to end up with more petitions being tabled, they have limited time and those sorts of things. And I suppose another question that comes to my mind is the 10,000, 100,000 limit. I mean, is there also a risk in terms of introducing, you know, if you get up to that number, something can or might happen, that you might be missing important issues in the community because they may not be popular, or they may be difficult to get support for. So I think there was two questions really in that.
No, definitely. And I mean, the numbers, I think they just act almost like a safety net as a threshold. And there's other systems like the Scottish system, for instance, or even the German system, which is a very well established system, where you don't have those thresholds as much, and where any petition is accepted and discussed. And there's definitely an argument, say, if something happens to it only at 10,000 signatures, you may actually be missing out a lot of things. You may be missing out issues that might come through say a minority group, or issues that don't affect a lot of people. And quite often you also have the other way around, which is some issues actually are not that important. It's just people are fed up with something. You know, for instance, a few years ago, we had, as you probably know, we had a referendum in this country. On the weekend after the referendum, a lot of people were very upset with the referendum, and the petitions committee was invaded with petitions. It was just, you know, a huge flow of petitions.
I think you had a petition,
Another example of that is one of Trump, for instance.
Yes, people didn't want
Trump to come to for state visits. That's what I call a protest type of petition. So it works both ways. You might get petitions actually that are not a particular action. It's just people fed up getting really high signatures. You may have real issues that actually don't come to the fore. But one of the things that the UK House of Commons Committee has done is, I mean, it has those thresholds because people clearly, they do participate a lot, they sign a lot of petitions. So it's almost like a safety net for them to work with, because otherwise it would be completely overwhelmed with the volume. And that you'll see that there's actions in different systems being in there. But the other thing that the system has is that because there is a committee, the committee can do anything that any other committees can do. So if they see value in a petition that maybe is not getting that many signatures, but actually it's really important, they may take action on it. So I'll give you an example. They had a petition about teaching British Sign Language in schools, which only got to something like 35,000 signatures, I think, after a long time. But that's the sort of issue that a lot of people would not connect with. And what the committee decided to do was to debate that petition anyway. And they actually did a lot of work with the petitioner. They brought the petitioner in, they did a small video with him, and did a lot of publicity around British Sign Language. And today, for instance, Prime Minister's Question Time in the UK, they are automatically translating to British Sign Language. And there's no doubt that started because the committee saw that petition that would never get a lot of signatures, but recognised there was an issue in there. And debated anyway. But it is a fine balance, though, and I totally agree with that. And each parliament, each community is different, so the numbers will be different for, you know, your parliament, and the numbers will be different for Scotland, and it's about finding that balance between the two of them.
Yes, yeah, and I appreciate that. And we don't have any minimum threshold for ours here, but there is no mechanism, for example, that if you reach a certain threshold that Parliament will debate your issue. I think it might be one of the matters on which we consider as we're going forward, because I think there are times when the most appropriate way of dealing with an issue is for it to be debated on the floor of Parliament rather than to be dealt with, you know, before a committee. It depends on the nature of the issue. But we've also commenced inquiries on the basis of petitions that have had one signature, because the substantive matter is an important one.
Yeah.
And as I say, that's what makes me think of those circumstances where you might be missing it if you set that sort of bar way too high. We've only got 2.5 million people here in Western Australia, so if you got 100,000 signatures on a petition, you'd be doing exceptionally well. I'm sure every government would be paying attention to what was in that because of that. So the biggest ones we usually get are about 15,000. That was the largest I think we've had during this term of Parliament. And those sorts of things. So I think what I picked up from your work is that, I've got a legal background and an alternate dispute resolution, and I probably relate it back to the concept of procedural fairness. It's about the process and how the process delivers that. And I think that comes through as one of your things, the six processes that you talk about. Do you have an idea about what the minimum amount of contact a dedicated petitioner's committee should have with a principal petitioner, for example? I know there's no magic formula, obviously, but what would your model process be?
Sorry?
What would your model process be?
Well, my process would be that every time an action is taken on a petition, that the petitioner is informed about that.
Okay, yeah.
So when a petition is received, that the petitioner know about that. If a petition, there's correspondence going to the government minister, that the petitioner knows about that. So every time there's an action in there, that the petitioner is informed about it. And this is because from outside, from the public's perspective into the parliament, you and staff may know that what work you're doing with petitions, and it may be just obvious for you. So, well, the procedure is to do this, so that's what we'll do, because that's what we have to do. But the public from outside doesn't see any of that. And there's so much mistrust on public institutions and on parliaments, that the fact that they don't see it, if they don't see it, they don't hear about it, it's almost as if it doesn't exist, it doesn't happen. And parliaments tend to have a very abstract image to the outside. And I've done lots of interviews with people who participated in sort of consultation type exercises in parliaments, whether it's petitioners, whether it's other types of exercises. And one of my favourite quotes from one of my interviewees was when she said that it was like throwing a ball into an ocean. So, you know, you throw it in there, you know it's somewhere in there, but you have no idea what's happened to it. So that feedback is really important. So it's difficult to say, because obviously, you know, it depends a lot on the processes, but as a general principle, every time an action is taken on a petition, then the petition should be informed.
Can I just follow up with that? So you've outlined basically six steps for information process, for want of a better word at this point in time. Any insight into the decision-making of committees along that information process? Because it's like, how does a committee make a decision that a petition with two signatures on it is worth pursuing or having an inquiry? Or there's other decisions a committee makes and may say it's frivolous and vexatious, so we won't continue with an inquiry. Have you had any in your research any insight into that decision making process rather than information flow?
Yeah, so do you mean in terms of what's informed, what the public hears from that? Is that what you mean, in terms of how much you say to the public, or...?
Yeah, I think we can easily tell... Well, hang on, I better rephrase that. You should be able to tell what the committee's doing, right?
Yeah.
Is what you're saying. But there's a whole level of decision-making behind that, the committee's doing. So have you any insight into what the decision-making behind the scenes
I'm referring really just to procedural type of information, so not necessarily to the decision making discussions between members. So, you know, if the committee is group meeting in private and doing their own discussions, I actually think there's a lot of leeway of keeping those private and not necessarily public. It's more about communicating what happened to it, that it's come in now and it's gone somewhere else now, it has made a decision, or the committee has decided just to archive it because there was no basis to carry on. So you're not going to please everyone, so you are going to take some decisions that people are not happy with, but it's about just explaining what's happened to it. It has been considered, it has been looked at, but it has been decided that it's not going to go forward. Now, in some cases, there might be some justifications, which again, you could see them as just procedural. And I know you have some questions about that. You know, for instance, if you have a repeat petition, if it's about the same issue, in my view, I don't see why that should be still taken into account. So that the justification could be, you know, it hasn't been taken into account or it has not been accepted because there's already one open on that. But it's about, again, it's always about following the procedures. It's always about using the procedures and explaining what's happening back to the petitioner. But it's not necessarily about going into the inside of that decision making or an inside of the different points of view from the committee, because the committee actually has more legitimacy in the work it does if it acts as one in terms of the decisions they make.
So just in terms of finalising petitions, so the practice of our committee is for the majority of petitions, what we will do is we'll receive them, we will ask the principal petitioner to provide us with a submission of no more than 2 pages, and also the tabling member, because every petition has to be tabled by a member. We don't accept petitions that are not tabled. And they can also make a submission. And then once we've received that submission, the normal step would then be to seek a response from the relevant government minister, or if it's a matter that pertains to local government, the local government, and rarely, but sometimes it might relate to a private organisation or a business, and to seek their response. And then what the committee will do is, after receiving those responses, we'll make a decision as to whether it makes further inquiries or it closes the petition. And typically when we close our petitions, what we do is we write back to the tabling member and the principal petitioner, advising them that this is the process that we've followed, and these were some of the responses received, but we don't provide any reasons or justifications for the actions we've taken, or why we are not engaging in further inquiry. And I suppose what we'd like from you is what your views might be on about how a committee should best inform a petitioner on the outcome of the committee's consideration. Should it just be perfunctory, or should there be substantive reasoning given? And I suppose you can nuance your answer, because you might say it could depend on the circumstances or the content of the petition, but we're just trying to get a better idea as to what you might think would deliver that, or narrow that expectation gap that exists between the citizen and its parliament.
I think that the reasons should be, it should always be linked to the process as much as possible. So if the committee has decided to close a petition because there's no argument in there to move forward, and if the committee feels happy and content with that decision, presumably it's because the committee has investigated that, has looked into the matter, and has come to that decision. And so as long as that's communicated in a clear manner to the petitioner, I don't see why that's an issue. It's difficult to say, because I know it's fine to say we'll just skip the process and give the sort of procedural reason behind it, and that the petitioner might contact you again and start in the discussion with that. But there are some times where those discussions just don't lead anywhere. They just go round and round and round. If there are those occasions, though, where actually the petitioner would be better off by going and do a specific action, then maybe that could be recommended to the petitioner. Yeah. So it's always the principle of applying the procedures, we're trying to find a solution for that petition. And it might be that actually it would be better off for the petitioner to go and campaign, for instance, with a different organisation, or build a case and then come back to you. So I would always follow the lead of trying to resolve the issue that the petitioner is raising, but sometimes resolving that might be to refer them somewhere else. So one of the things, for instance, that I think is good practice is when you close a petition, but say, this is as much as we've been able to do. And it might be that you actually have been able to advance the issue a lot. You might have been able to get a response from government or a change of some sort. But in any case, to say this is what you can do now if you want to pursue this issue. So you could go and do a campaign, or you could go and contact so-and-so. Because petition, it's always important, I think, to understand and to communicate that to the public, that the petition itself doesn't achieve anything. It's what you do with the petition that achieves a change. So if you are addressing your committee with that petition, that's great, but you only, things will change only if your committee does something with it. If your committee does something with it and achieves that change, great. If actually it goes beyond what you, your actions, beyond your remit, then it's up to the petitioner to think about what else can I do? And quite often, as you know, being in politics, politics doesn't change from one day to the other. It's about a drip sequence of actions over a number of years, and then eventually you might achieve a change, you might achieve a small change that you might even not have been what you want to do from the beginning. So I think guiding the petitioner in terms of these are the procedures, this is what we've done, and this is what we achieved, and if you want to pursue it more, then what about if you go and contact whoever, or you can do whatever this, or you can take it in this way.
I think one of the issues we have with managing expectations as a committee is that it's usually other members of parliament that institute petitions as a way of dealing with a constituent's issue, and they may, while we may give as much information as possible about the process and what's possible, it's often the other, our colleagues that are usually not managing the expectation gap and potentially saying, you know, the petition might be able to achieve more than it can possibly achieve. Now, I'm not sure there's much we can do about that, because even if we took the responsibility away from members of parliament for tabling petitions and did an e-petition type process that didn't require that, I mean, members of parliament would still encourage people to do e-petitions, and there'll be those that would use that sort of process. I think there's some vexatious matters in the process we're never going to be able to resolve.
Yeah, because in that case, you're looking at petitions that are not necessarily just driven and led by the public. They're also mingled with politics. So they're also led then and used as a political discussion, let's call it, between different members. And then you have a different nature to petitions, really. And we still see a little bit of that with, because in the UK, we still have the traditional MP petition, which is submitted by a member. But they're not the e-petitions, and so they're just brought in by specific members. And obviously they are usually about constituency matters. But I think that there's value in all petitions, but you sort of change slightly the nature of a petition when it is linked to a member, because if a member then is using that as part of their political campaign, then it becomes more about the politics of the parties to the members than instead just about the public. To see in terms of the difference, and then I totally agree with you, it becomes very difficult to then to manage expectations, because then you're basically managing party politics type of expectations, which is really difficult to deal with, particularly in the current climate.
Yes. We our committee is cross-party, so we have that benefit here of the fact that we've all, have to take responsibility for what our own parties do to us. So, you know, someone can go back to their party room and go, what do you think you're doing? But that's the benefit here, is that whatever outcomes we've got, it's got broad, you know, support across the parties. But just in terms of what petitions shouldn't be accepted, and I think I've got from you an impression that almost all should be accepted in one shape or another, but we do have obviously petitions that raise repetitious matters, but we also have petitions which could only ever be described as vexatious, and so we're always in a balance of how we deal with those. Do you have any sort of idea how to deal with those sort of petitions that might, for example, raise, you know, salacious or defamatory allegations against others, or just simply trite in what they're asking for?
Yeah, so again, it's about how you set the rules, and if it's breaking the rules, then you should just not accept it. So I'm not saying by any means that you should accept all petitions, and I think there's nothing wrong as not accepting it if they're not meeting the rules. So, and that is difficult for me to say, because it depends so much from culture to culture, from parliament to parliament. But in general, what I see from different parliaments is obviously anything that is offensive shouldn't be accepted. anything that is inflammatory shouldn't be accepted. But all of these things is also interpretive, you know, subjective interpretations, obviously. And then anything that is not requiring an actual, a clear action, maybe shouldn't be accepted. So some parliaments really demand a specific action to be taken rather than just an opinion. And that's a useful way of differentiating different types of positions. And we've got another question later on about the courts. I don't know if you want to talk about that, but
in my view,
it shouldn't be something that is under the courts at the time. And I don't know if you want to talk about that now for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is just the core principles that the political should interfere with the judicial. And so if you start having political decisions or decisions made within a political institution that are being discussed within the judiciary, you could say that there's interference in there. But also if a process is going through courts, they'll be going through a lot of evidence, quite often confidential evidence that the parliament wouldn't necessarily have access to. So it will just mix up and make the process very messy for no one's benefit, and you have too many voices hearing. So I think the principle of dealing with petitions when they're not, you know, not dealing with petitions whilst they're in court, I think it's a good one, and it avoids problems of interpretations, problems with institutions. Mm. Now, having said that, some systems, like in Germany, for instance, they have an ombudsman role, which is slightly different to being the courts. It's about resolving issues. And in there, it's very much about when it's private issues, personal issues. And are your petitions just about public, about the collective good, or are they also about private matters?
Yeah.
And again, you know, there's different ways of interpreting it. And in the German system, they effectively have what they call the res public and the res private type of petitions. So the res private is almost like the ombudsman issue, and what they do there is they deal with a specific petitioners and organisations. So it's usually issues of, you know, grievance of employment, for instance, that sort of thing, and they deal almost like a one-to-one process of resolving grievances and trying to bring the employees together with a petition or whatever the issue might be. And then they have the res public, which are the ones from which effectively that you can take lessons from it, that you could draw a legislation out of it, and it affects the collective. So it's not just about resolving the individual issue of one person, but it's about the collective. And I think increasingly, really, because we're working more and more in public spaces, particularly in parliaments, and because there's more and more demand that parliaments are, the discussions are public, are about the public good, that petitions dealt by parliament should be more and more about that collective. Could we make a law out of that? Could we, you know, scrutinise a legislation, a particular law that would affect everyone, rather than just a private matter of one person? So it's very different types of subjects in there, and it's about establishing where you think you are, because a lot of it is to do with traditions of the country, isn't it, and yes. Of the nation, of the region. So in the German system, because of their tradition of ombudsman and petitioning, that's how it works for them. And so as a result of that, for instance, the res public, so the collective type of petitions, you can find them online. The others, you can't find them online. They are private matters.
Mm.
But they're very, very different nature. In the UK, that just would not work. That would just be, it would just not work because of the system. But in my view, it should be kept separate so that there's no interference between the judicial and the political. But in terms of what you accept, what do you not accept, you know, there's core principles, and the core principles to me are, it should ask for an action, it should not be offensive or defamatory, and it should be about something that you can do about, you know, that parliament can do, that parliament has jurisdiction of.
Yes.
Over.
Yeah. And do you have a view about vexatious and frivolous petitions? Just more specifically, in terms of what the process might be best to deal with them, because often, if they're frivolous or vexatious, then the intent of the petitioner is probably not is generally one of malice, I suppose, or just time wasting. But sometimes people are just misguided, and so while they and they have a underlying substantive issue that they need to be addressed, but they just don't know how to deal with it in a constructive way. Do you think there's a role then for committees to help them through? I mean, it almost sounds like social work to some degree. But yeah, and all parliaments will have this. We call them frequent flyers often.
So, I mean, what I can say is about what I know of how parliaments have dealt with those.
Yeah.
And if you decide that the only accepting petitions that ask for specific action, then if you're doing that, it would get rid of a lot of those, because a lot of those, they're not actually asking for specific action. They're just giving a comment, or they're just, you know, saying something that is so frivolous that there's actually no action in there. If there's still an action, though, and you can see clearly it's not a serious action, it's not something taken seriously, the UK Parliament does have as one of its categories jokes or similar things, which I think some of it would fall into that, and they just reject them because they're not taken seriously. So they take that as one of the reasons. Another, I suppose, something else to bear in mind is that, I know you don't have that system, but if you have people signing the petitions and by itself identifying the ones that do matter, the ones that don't matter, then that's another way of sifting them through. So if it is a frivolous or, you know, vexatious issue, very likely it will not be signed by other people because it's just someone having a go, trying to make a point. And so another way of differentiating them is it's by letting the public decide. So which ones are they signing? And if you say, you know, your threshold is 20 signatures or whatever, those are more likely to not get to those 20 signatures. So that's another way of dealing with them.
Mm.
But in whatever these things, well, if you have a criteria like you need at least 20 signatures or 100 signatures to be considered, then that's a quite objective criteria. But if you have, if your criteria is about asking for action or not being a joke, then as you know, coming from a legal background, it's always going to be some interpretation, some level of interpretation there, and some level of subjective interpretation, therefore.
Mm.
And in there, I think in those cases, about making sure you have clear procedures, those are communicated clearly to the public, and about having confidence in those procedures and in what's being communicated, and decide, no, this is frivolous, this is actually not a proper petition, I'm not going to waste my time on this, and move on to something else.
Yeah, yes. I mean, we don't have a minimum number of signatures. I think our minimum is one.
No.
And so, and that in itself has been a positive and a negative. I think one of the issues we have here is that the convention in the Legislative Council in Western Australia is if a member is asked to table a petition, regardless of its content, the member generally agrees to do it, and they won't necessarily be endorsing the petition by the fact it's been tabled, but that's the convention, that if someone wants that to happen, I know some members do refuse in certain circumstances, but others just see it as part of their duty to do that. So it may be something we have to give more consideration to as we go forward. In terms of petitions that deal with substantially the same matter, we know in the Scottish Parliament that they do have provisions for that, which it seems to me to be quite rigid. Do you have a view about that specifically, about petitions that deal with substantially the same matters? I mean, we often get ones that are different only by degrees, and that the petitioner or the tabling member argues that it's not the same as the previous petition, and that there is a, you know, it's usually a very fine argument about difference. I suppose you might say to us, well, that's really a matter that you decide as a committee, but it kind of undermines, because it takes up our time, you know, at what stage. We've actually just had a session with the South African Parliament, and they talk about a lot of their petitions are dealt with by their procedures office, or the people, the parliamentary officers, before they get to the committee itself, and they will reject petitions at that stage rather than having them come before the parliament and then to the committee, and then the committee makes that decision. So do you have a view about the different systems and what might be best to keep that open, accountable parliament type model and managing the expectation gap that you talk about?
Yeah, so I was going to talk about that. I was trying to think of a term, but I can't think of a term. So sort of a scaling up type of process, which in some ways is a bit what you just described. So you may have that some decisions are taken by the parliamentary staff themselves. It doesn't have to go to members, and about which ones, you know, some should be accepted, some should not be accepted. And then when there is, coming back to the issue of interpretation, if there's a doubt about it, you know, whether it's an action, whether it's not an action, whether it's offensive or not, then moving that forward to the top clerk within that team, and then from that to the clerk, as, you know, who's above them in terms of their boss, clerk of the journals would be in the UK. And if that still doesn't solve, then take it to the committee, and then the committee makes a decision. And because the committee are the representatives, then ultimately it will, that decision is the one that stands. So that's one way of having a sort of almost like hierarchy of taking those decisions. So not the same group is deciding all of them. But it's just, you know, the simplest decisions are made by a specific group, and then it scales up. In terms of whether to have the same matters, again, it is going to come back to interpretation, but I think if the same matter is on a petition that is a live petition that is being considered by Parliament, then I don't see why there should be a new petition about that. So I think, in my view, it should be a reason for not accepting a petition because there's one already being discussed in that matter. But again, it'll come back to interpretation. So some people might say, well, mine is slightly different. And I know the UK House of Commons, one of the main discussions they have with potential petitions is exactly about that. So the main reason, the main criteria why petitions are rejected in the UK Parliament is because of repetition. So it's people trying to submit a petition that is already out there, is still open, and is being considered. So petitions in the UK, they're open for 6 months, and during that time they're collecting signatures, and then after that, or sometimes in between, they may debate it, other things may happen. And if there's a petition on the same topic that you want to submit, and that's still live, then it's not accepted. And that I... Personally, I think that's a perfectly fine criteria to use to reject petitions, to not accept it. I don't like the term reject, which is a term the UK House of Commons use. I think it's better to say to not accept because it doesn't fit the criteria. In the Portuguese Parliament, you have the tradition of having lots of repeat tradition petitions, and that quite often is used in Portugal case by organisations like trade unions. So trade unions will have their members, say it's the teachers' trade unions, for example, just for the sake of argument, will submit a petition, and they'll have their teachers' members submitting the same petition effectively, saying the same thing. And I don't see why, you could group them, but if it's exactly the same petition, I think it's a better practice to just have one petition and have lots of people signing it. Yes. And then showing the support of that petition, rather than going through the same process, which can be a quite long-winded process and take quite a bit of resources when actually you're actually addressing them all in one go. Mm. So in my view, I think it's perfectly legitimate to make the argument, there is already a petition on this topic, so instead, if you want to support that, go and sign that one or follow this process.
Yeah.
Rather than having repeat petitions. And then there's other things you can do, but again, it always comes back to interpretation because, you know, the team in the House of Commons, and I've seen them doing that, they will have discussions with petitioners who will insist that petition is different from something else. So what they do in the UK House of Commons is, if you submit a petition and they, in their argument, in their reasoning, they think there's another petition exactly on the same topic, they'll email back to you and say, this has not been accepted, or they'll say, this has been rejected because there's already a petition on this topic. And they put the link on the email and say to them, go and sign this one. But quite often what happens is that petitioner might go back to the committee and say, no, mine is not about that. Mine is about something different. And then there's a discussion. If they manage to convince the clerk that theirs is indeed different with different consequences, then they'll let it open. If they don't manage to convince the clerk, they'll say, no, I'm sorry, but it is the same. Just go and sign that petition. But there's always going to be a level of interpretation, obviously. And something else also that... in parliaments where there's a debate of petitions, what you might do is when it comes to the debate on inquiry, what it might be, is have petitions which may be on very similar issues and deal with them together, which I'm sure you already do anyway. So, for instance, UK Parliament last year, there was lots and lots and lots of petitions about Brexit. Each one slightly different, so each one obviously accepted because it was slightly different. And what you end up with was debates on Brexit from both sides, because there were petitions from one side, petitions from the other side, and they were just all brought together and they, you know, they discuss about those in that way.
Yeah, so if, just for your information, for us, like if we have can you hear me now? Sorry, Val, just for your information, our process here is we often get a petition that's tabled by a member, and then during the course of our inquiries into that petition, another member might table an identical or very substantial petition, and what we usually do is join them together in that regard. But early on in our parliamentary term of this parliament, we had multiple different petitions, or slightly different petitions, regarding fluoride in water, because our water corporation here was starting to fluorinate water in some of our remote and regional towns, and there's a particular group that was going around getting petitions signed, and each petition was slightly different because it related to a different town, and we did all our work up front on the first one that came in, and then subsequent to that, when they came through, we simply referred them to the work and the responses of government that had happened in relation to the very first one, because they were substantially the same, because what they were doing was they were anti-fluoride, they didn't want it to happen, they claimed it was a poison and all those sorts of things, or a medication, and so the work had been done up front. So we've been able to sit back on all the work we did in the first petition and refer them to that, and unfortunately I think they've dried up a little bit now, so if you pardon the pun for water, but yeah, so that's the process that we've used, but it's not one that we've got written down anywhere, it's what we've talked about and discussed amongst ourselves. Colin?
So just to follow on that from your example where you had Brexit, some Brexit petitions often in opposing views, would you say their expectations were met when they weren't dealt with in a sense? Because one of the things is about expectation, information flow, relaying your decision, and the committee's probably got nowhere to go really except to say, well, we note your petition and it's being dealt with in a parliamentary sense or a government sense. Do you think that's okay in terms of what the petitioners expect out of that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I think so. I think that as long as it's clear, you know, we'll debate, we'll try to do our influence in the way we can, but obviously don't expect necessarily that you'll get a change from that. It's the same with any petition, so it's a type of scale. So the Brexit petitions are what I call protest type of petitions, and as any protest type of petitions, it is about making your voice heard. So just like people join a demonstration out in the streets, they're just angry about something, unsatisfied about something, they go and do a demonstration. They don't necessarily expect the government is going to change their law, their policy, but at least they've expressed their views and they feel that they've made the noise. And with a Brexit type of petition, it's the same type of issue. A lot of people are very unhappy about the situation. But also, I mean, in this case, to be fair, it's also about showing, you know, there's actually opposing views on the same thing, and it's one of those issues that really has divided the country. And sometimes, in the UK, if you're part from a community of people who did vote Remain, and all of their families and friends, they're all from Remain, they can't possibly see how we could leave the European Union, it's actually useful for those people to see that there are other people who feel in a different way, and if Parliament is reflecting that, it's bringing those two communities together and showing there are opposing views. So again, it is performing that role of, you know, showing satisfaction, but at the same time also showing there's different perspectives. If I speak personally, I was someone who voted to Remain, and a lot of my family's people around me are from a Remain background. But if you are in that group, it's actually really difficult to see the perspective from the other group, because you only deal, particularly in social media days and all of that, it really can live in a bubble and you don't see the other perspective. And what something like the Brexit petitions debates have done is to show there are different points of view, and there are people who may be perfectly, you know, nice and normal like you, who just think differently from you. And I think that Parliament, you know, just makes those... just a way of expressing that. And so again, I come back, expectations, not necessarily about getting what you wanted, it's about having the feel that you've been listened to. That's not to say that there's not a lot of people unhappy that they have left the EU, just like the other way, if we had stayed, a lot of people would be unhappy because we had stayed. It's just the nature of politics.
Yes, yeah. In your paper, you state that a high volume of petitions are rejected in the UK House of Commons. Are you able to sort of explain to us why that might be the case?
What was the question? Sorry, I said?
It says in your paper, you talk about a high volume of petitions that are rejected by the House of Commons, and we just want to understand what the different reasons that might be.
Petitions are.
Yeah. So I'll give you a very simple reason,
yeah.
Which is an advantage and a disadvantage. It's the fact that it's so easy to submit a petition.
Right, okay.
So if you go to the Scottish Parliament, for instance, or the European Parliament, or many other parliaments, Portuguese Parliament, Irish Parliament, and you want to submit an petition online, you have to register first, you have to give a load of information, and then you create your petition. If you want to create a petition in the UK House of Commons, 10 minutes, you've got a petition created.
Yeah.
And in some ways, that's good, because it is very, very accessible. And there's people that I interviewed, for instance, who have never voted in their life, who created a petition and then suddenly got to 100,000 signatures and ended up in Parliament, visiting Parliament and all of that. So it's got a good side to it. The negative side to it is that because it's so easy to submit, and the system, for instance, doesn't necessarily check. It's supposed to check for repeat petitions, but it doesn't really do it very well. That's something that they're working on to try to change. A lot of the petitions that are rejected are actually repeat petitions. They were petitions about something that's just happened, that there is a petition about it already. So it's either, you know, because it's done very quickly, so it's not written properly, it's not clear what the action is, or it might be about something that government or parliament can't do. And quite often what happens with petitions also is that they happen in what are called waves of petitions. So now we have the crisis of coronavirus. Whenever anything big happens in the country, that's then reflected in the petition system. And obviously with the coronavirus COVID-19 crisis, we've had a huge influx of petitions about that. And, you know, like the volume is triple the size at the moment. It's just absolutely going in every day. And what happens with that is that even if you had a system that checks for repeat petitions, you may have a queue of petitions that are waiting to be moderated, which you can't see them online yet. So you think your petition is not there yet, but you submit something, it's just still being considered by the staff, and they're just not doing it quickly enough, and you can't see it in there. And quite often the repeat petitions come in those ways. People are just unhappy about the situation, and they decide to submit a petition. So the main reason why they're rejected is, it's because they're repeated. That's the main thing. The other one is where, because the action is not clear. Another one might be because it's not something that Parliament or government can do.
Do you have a view where the balance should sit in terms of that, the bar for getting in terms of a petition? We don't have e-petitions here in Western Australia. It's a matter that's been under constant consideration by our Privileges Committee, but hasn't yet been adopted. And so I guess the question is, would you prefer the Scottish system in terms of a higher bar, or the House of Commons system, which by your own account there was a much lower bar, in terms of what's a better model?
I think I'll prefer the latter one, the UK system, but with a better online technology. Because so the system was introduced in 2015 and it works very well, but there's lots of issues with it that need to be addressed. And now it's 2020 and they still haven't been addressed. And in here, there's another point that comes in, that is the fact it's a collaborative system. So the actual site is managed by the government digital service. So the staff in Parliament, they know what the problems are, they deal with these problems day in, day out, but it's making the two teams work together and changing it. That hasn't quite happened yet. But to answer to your question, if we had to choose between one and the other, I would go for the latter, because the former one, where you have to register, I mean, there's lots of advantages to it also, but what happens to it is that it's the usual suspects that are participating. It's the usual people who would be accessing the system anyway who are getting involved. And, I mean, in some ways, there's nothing wrong with that, but it depends what you want to do with the petition system. If you want it to be a real, genuine, up-down, bottom-up way of bringing issues to the fore that MPs might not be aware of, then obviously the more open you keep it, the better, because otherwise you might get just people who are already, you know, the lawyers, the academics, the journalists, the professionals who already know about the issues. They already know how to address those. They already know about how to write to a member or how to contact the professional associations. And if I think of some of the most interesting petitions that have been brought to the UK Parliament, they are not by those people, actually, interestingly. So, for instance, there was one about car insurance for young people because it's so expensive. There's another one about paedophiles, about having a register for paedophiles. Another one about British Sign Language. Any of these were not submitted by your usual suspects. They're submitted by people from either working class, people who've never voted before. And the reason why they submitted the petition is because they got really, really annoyed about an issue. You know, they got really, it really touched them. It's what I call substantive type of petitions. And so they got so annoyed and fed up with something that they went and submitted that petition. However, you know, if there are an online system, if it's making it too accessible and getting everything in, then it also can get in the way of parliamentary staff. And you could argue by having so many, then you're not giving enough attention to those who could have the attention. So what I would have is have the latter system, but have it, tweak it and improve it, because there's a lot of things you can do with technology now. One of my supervisor PhD students, we're working on digital engagement, what you can do with digital tools. And it's never going to be a substitute for by people by any ways, but there's lots of ways it can select, it can guide, and I think it just needs to be improved on, really.
Mm. Can I just ask a question on follow-up to that? Because I think it's a really interesting point, that the UK system, what you're arguing is, has increased participation for those people who don't generally participate in the more formal sense. But do you think it also increases the participation rates by those guys who do know the system? So they also flood the system, the e-petition system?
I think those people, they're already up there. They're already using the system anyway. So there is a particular group of people who tend to use a lot e-petitions. And those people, they're already doing that, regardless of Parliament having an e-petition site, actually. But they're going to change.org, for instance, or to Avaaz, they're going to those other sites. So, yes, so the answer to your question is yes, in terms of there's more of a disparity between the two groups. And that's why it's important, even more important, that Parliament or the Listed Council, whatever it may be, does make their system more participatory, so you're not getting exactly the same people. But there is evidence to show that with in today's politics, there are particular groups of people and particular groups of interest, for instance, environmental issues. Environmental issues are one of those typical areas where e-petitions are very popular, and they are a particular tool of participation and acting in politics. And those are very, very active, yeah. And that's why it's important to, as much as possible, to bridge that gap. To show that, you know, Joe Bloggs out on the street, who actually has no connections whatsoever, but has as many problems as anyone else, knows that they can raise their issues also.
Mm. Thank you.
Yeah, here, planning issues are perhaps one of the most common ones we have to deal with, which is interfaced with environmental issues as well. There's certain areas of the city and the state which seem to give us more than other areas, if I can put it that way. So we do have this issue where even our paper-based petition system still entrenches some privileges, and there's still groups out there that don't understand the processes. And we have compulsory voting here in Western Australia, of course, so almost everybody does participate in the political process, but it would be fair to say that we have people who have much better developed complaining skills than other people, and so they're more inclined to use the resources of the committee. I mean that with the greatest of respect, of course. And that's part of the issue about whether or not we reach all those groups that want to access us. So this really leads me into the question, the vexed question of, do you have any suggestions for us about how we might improve our committee system? I'm not sure if you've had much chance to examine what we do, but is there anything in particular that stands out that you think we could do better or differently that would improve or that the expectation gap, that would narrow it, that would increase our accountability and openness to our constituents?
Yes, I mean, obviously, it's always a bit arrogant, I think, to people from outside come and say what you should be doing, because you know much better what you're doing than, you know, than I do. But just from having a quick look at the processes online and from what I know of other parliaments, I'd say one of the things that maybe would help would be to change the name of the committee so that people understand better that this committee deals with petitions, because it's not necessarily that clear from people the outside. This is the petitions committee. And then in terms of communicating, making those communications clearer, something that I think parliaments often struggle to do is to understand how to communicate in a way that the public actually understands, in a way that is as plain language as possible. And there's lots of reasons for that, because parliamentary language is obviously there, it's part of the processes, and that's the language we use to deal with the processes. But it really is useful, and it does pay off by having some work done on looking at how processes are communicated to the outside world in a way that someone might not know much about Parliament would understand it.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, obviously, you don't have e-petitions and you're not considering that at the moment, but that can bring lots of advantages in terms of an area, again, we haven't spoken much about, but it's the signatories, you know, what you can do with the signatories of people who have supported the petition. And by using that system of being able to communicate back, but it's not communicating back just to the petitioner, but also to the people who are supporting them. So I imagine at the moment you can't really do that. It can only correspond with the petitioner, but not the people who have signed it. And that brings a different pool of people to which to talk to about those issues. Mm. And then, I mean, I don't know how much you do in terms in your inquiries, but one of the things that has worked well and that distinguishes the UK House of Commons from other parliaments that I've looked at is the range of different, like they almost have like a portfolio of different types of activities they can do. So having that flexibility, being able to do one-to-one hearings or to be able to do workshops on the issue, trying to get more views from the public about what are the matters, what are the real problems in there. So whether it's in face-to-face, so they've done deliberative workshops with face-to-face people, but they've also done online forums, online surveys, they've used social media also for that. But the example, what I want to single out here is a portfolio of different types of activities that you can have. And I think that's useful because if we think that all petitions are the same and should be processed the same way, then maybe we're missing out a little bit in there. And some petitions will be useful to do some things, others it would not be useful to do that and to do something else instead. So that would be one of the things I would suggest that you might be able to do without having to change much in terms of what you already do.
Mm. All right. Does anyone else have any more questions? No? All right, Professor, we really do appreciate you taking the time today to share your insights and expertise with us. I don't think it's arrogant in the slightest for you to share your views about what we might do better. We've asked you to do that specifically because I think it's really important for us to not just continue to do the same things over and over again without having some sort of reflection on that as a parliament. And as I said, I think at the beginning, there was a lack of academic research and commentary in this space, which I think you probably are very well aware aware of, but it's such an important and obvious way for parliaments to get better connection with their constituencies, aside from the actions of government. And so if we can do it better, we need to find ways of doing that, of course, and we'll see how we go with our committee. But I will say to you, we do have, because we're a bicameral system here, and the Legislative Assembly, it has a petitions process, but all it does is table them. They don't do anything unless the House makes a specific resolution, which I don't think they've done in this term of Parliament, to investigate it, whereas our Legislative Council process is more of the starting, the tabling of the petition is a starting point for further inquiry, not the end point. And I think it would be good if the protest petition has stayed in the Legislative Assembly so that they can just protest if that's what they want to do, and then they can leave us with the ones that actually, you know, we can dedicate our resources and energy. But thank you very much for participating. What we'll do is, from this point, our Hansard will send you, and our clerk will send you a copy of the transcript of today's hearing. If you can review that transcript and make any edits that you think don't accurately reflect the evidence that you've got, if, for example, there's a substantive change you need to make, you will need to put it in a separate letter to say that, you know, it doesn't reflect your view, because sometimes that happens. But I'm sure you're familiar with the Hansard process and as it is. But while that Hansard is being, that transcript is in train, it remains private. So if you can just not make it public at all until it's made public. On our website. It will be published on the website later on. And our process going forward, we may send you some more questions if through the course of our inquiry and deliberations some additional issues arise. So if you're happy to take those, we may send them to you as we go. But our process will be to consider, we've got some more hearings coming up, and then to deliberate, and then hopefully we'll write a report. And I hope you, in fact, we probably will send you a copy of the report as a courtesy, so and all that stuff. So I hope you're keeping well in this COVID crisis over there. You guys have been more significantly affected by it than we have. But thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. And yes, any questions, please do come back to me. That's absolutely fine. My pleasure. I hope it was useful.
No, it was. Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.